I'm here at the Serpentine Gallery at the Langlands and Bell exhibition. Ben Langlands and Nikki Bell have worked as one since 1978. They reconstruct fragments of the real world as pristine architectural models, creating layers of implied meanings. I'm going to look first at the work here, the first work where you used a building plan, Traces of Living.
Yes, this was a work that we made for an exhibition at the Interim Art Gallery in 1986 in the East End of London. This is the first work where we've used a model of a building in a chair. It's encased in a glass seat, and the model is of the basement of the National Gallery in Trafalgar Square, where work is normally stored.
The three tables in the work they function as vitrines. They have glass surfaces, and in the voids below the glass surfaces are displayed objects which we found in and around the area where we live in the East End of London. So there are a range of things from a London yellow stock brick, which all the buildings there are made out of, to a plate of candles which had belonged to an elderly Jewish lady, to a dried fish from the halal grocers at the end of our street, to a stale loaf of bread with a dried rat in it, and a dried cauliflower from the market.
If we look over here, there's some more of your furniture, a series of interlocking chairs, which you sometimes describe as dysfunctional furniture.
Yes, the interlocking chairs are actually not meant to be sat on. They're signs for chairs, and they're also about our relationship to furniture and the way that the chair mediates between the body and the building.
Just as in a way one can see architecture as a code of relationships, so furniture is also a parallel structural code. Chairs are found everywhere in buildings. In a sense, they're common denominators in architecture, indicating the human presence or absence. The distribution of chairs in a building will usually indicate what type of building it is and how it's used. The furniture in a conference centre or a school or a prison will describe very much what goes on there and the relationships between the people using the building.
You rarely use colour in your work, preferring pristine white or black. Yet over here we've got a series of buildings, corporate buildings, where you've used bright primary colours and secondary colours.
Yes, we tend to use colour only very sparingly, because we feel that colour can often detract rather than enhance something. But in this case, we were doing an exhibition in Frankfurt, and what struck us about the plans of these company headquarters was their incredible logoistic motif of the plan itself. And we wanted to highlight this and emphasise this and bring out the heraldic and the emblematic quality of those plans.
Yes, we were very, very struck by this because the centre of Frankfurt is full of these high-rise buildings, which are sort of corporate citadels. And when we examined the plans, as Nikki said, they really resembled logos, not the actual logos of the company, but the sort of generic logo types. And we were intrigued by the way this logocentric design strategy runs right through the company, from the letterhead on their notepaper to their headquarters building. So, in a sense, the buildings are projecting the company's identity in the city through this very kind of simple, iconic design. In fact, what's even more sort of amusing in a way is that some of the plans seem to have a kind of allegorical link to the functions of the company. So you've got Unilever, which is a very striking plan which resembles three levers rotating around a central core. Then there's Deutsche Bank, which is the twin towers of the building, which have been nicknamed credit and debit by the employees of the company. And there's BMW in Munich, which is four circles around a square core and looks almost like a machine part, like a cylinder head, or maybe the four wheels of a vehicle. And the IBM plan even resembles microcircuitry. So it's quite astonishing.
Moving over here, We've got what was the tallest building in the world, the Sears Tower in Chicago.
Yes, normally one gazes up at the tower in the city, but here what we've done is we've taken slices through it at the four different stages of the building. We were interested by the plan because it's a module of nine squares. So at the lowest level, the ground floor level, it's a perfect square made up of nine squares together. And at each stage, two of the squares are removed, so it mutates. The second panel shows it with two squares removed to make two squares. And in the third panel, two more squares are removed, and it becomes a cross. And finally, it becomes just a rectangular slab. So in a sense, we were taking slices through the building and laying them out like samples or specimens of the internal structure and giving you another view, one that you wouldn't normally have of this sort of very tall icon.
Yes, and looking across at the UNESCO building.
Yes, it has three sides to it, all of which aren't equal. It's a sort of propeller-like shape. It's a very dynamic sort of, it's almost like a found object which has just been plonked in the middle of Paris, designed by Marcel Breuer. And formerly, what interested us initially was its shape. And here we're showing it on one side stripped bare, and on the other side how it is clad when the building is actually completed.
So another triptych, the Steinheim prison.
Yes, this is a prison in Stuttgart in Germany, and it's actually the prison where the Baader-Meinhof group were found dead.
In 1977. The piece was made for an exhibition in Stuttgart in 1990, and what we've done is we've glazed the panels with grey perspex under glass to give the model a kind of distance and detachment, which accentuates the kind of regime of and sort of impersonal nature of the institution. The reason why we often use architectural models is because it's not so easy to read an architectural drawing or plan, but once you see it in three dimensions, then anybody can read it instantly.
If we move over here, you've got some very interesting developments where you've taken things like flights, paths of aeroplanes, surrounding time, and the concept of kind of bending time, which I think you've talked about on previous occasions.
Yes, time is an important aspect of the work, and we like to link often very different buildings together from very different times. And here with the air routes in Northwest Europe, day and night, the images above us, which are in the sky, have actually been traced, and so you can actually see the air routes.
This is one of a group of works which we made for an exhibition in France in 1989 at Le Magasin, where we combined the architecture of European airports with European political institutions. And we were alluding to the way the political landscape and cultural and social landscape of Europe is being altered, and there are people trying to alter it consciously by building buildings to house the functions of this new political sort of power, in a sense. And in this group of works is this work, Air Routes in Northwest Europe, Night and Day, where we've silkscreen printed on glass the lines of the European airlines. And you can see it's like a kind of spider's web of lines linking the different cities of Europe. And it traces out a kind of ghostly geography of Europe, which is
normally not visible, but here we're making it visible.
Over here we have the burnt chair, Westminster.
Yes, this shows the areas of the Houses of Parliament which burnt down. And the model inside the chair seat has also been burnt. And the back of the chair shows the chamber of the new House of Commons with the oppositional benches and the crossbenches as you enter. And in a way, it's talking about fragility and the way that nothing is permanent and that often life is very tragic.
I've walked through now to the main entrance of the Serpentine, where you've done this quite stunning installation and obviously worked very much with the architecture of the building, which not only reflects into the work but also talks about the work, the mosques and the ecclesiastical buildings that you've been dealing with here.
Yes, this room is a large square room with a domed ceiling, a rotunda. And what we've done is we've made a circular table which we've placed in the centre of the room. The table is burnt beech and has glass vitrines in it, a bit like the other tables. The room is a perfect square, and what we've done is we've divided the plan of the room into 9 squares so that we have one at the centre. And the circumference, the outer circumference of the table, touched the all 4 sides of that square. So it's placed exactly at the centre of the room, and the proportions of the table are linked intrinsically to the proportions of the room.
Why mosques?
We've been working with a series of religious buildings, not just mosques, but churches and synagogues as well. We're interested in religious architecture and the way that it embodies systems of belief. At the moment, people are questioning systems of belief, particularly in the light of the situation where so many ideologies appear to be discredited after the end of the Cold War. And they're often redefining their social identities in religious terms rather than in demographic or ideological terms. So this was, in a way, what inspired us to start looking at religious architecture and what sort of significance it holds for people.
So if we walk around and just look at some of the buildings and talk specifically about them.
Yes, here we have the Great Mosque of Baibars in Cairo. And it's floating in a dark void. It's suspended in time. And it clearly shows the whole idea of the religious enclosure.
The building is full of rows upon rows of arches supported by columns. And in a sense, the columns can give one a sort of feeling of the sort of multitude of people that use the building and that have used it. This is a work called The Abbey Church of St. Benedictus Vaals, Holland, the Kaaba Mecca. It's a diptych of 2 panels, and we've juxtaposed a perspective of the interior of the Abbey Church at Vaals with a silkscreen print of the silkscreen print on glass of the Kaaba in Mecca. The Abbey Church in Vaals is a building designed by a man called Don van der Laan, who is a Benedictine monk. It was designed in the 1960s and completed in the 1980s. So we were interested in the way the building is a very simple illustration of the place of perspective in European and Judeo-Christian culture. And, of course, it's a way of viewing and ordering the world. And one of the things about architecture is that at its most elemental, it's an enclosure. And it's an enclosure of useful space in the endless space, or apparently endless space, of nature. And the thing about the religious building is that it emphasizes this strategy because it's enclosing useful space in the absolute endlessness of oblivion. The geometry of the religious building is predicated on the assumption of a mythic geometry, which orders events beyond the building's point of focus, in other words, beyond this world. So we're contrasting this very sort of Western-centered way of viewing the world with and ordering the world and attempting to order the next world. and attempting to project social and personal identities beyond this world. We're contrasting that with a worldview of Islam, which also uses architecture to focus the concentration and belief of a community, in this case with the Kaaba in Mecca, which is a very simple cube, which is in fact a pre-Islamic structure, which is at the center of the Great Mosque. All mosques face the Great Mosque at Mecca, and the reason why is because the Kaaba is at the center. So it's the focus of Islam on earth. So every Muslim knows when they're praying that every other Muslim is facing in the same direction, and that every one of them will also visit the Great Mosque and see the Kaaba. So in a sense, one can imagine a kind of the world enclosed by this kind of very complex and endless web net of focusing on this point at Mecca. And it's another way of defining and projecting belief and identity.
Robert Prime, here we are in List 96 in Basel. Tell me why you think it's important to be here.
It's basically a vitrine where you get a different public that might not come to London, that might not come to the gallery to see what you're doing. That's a basic function, more even than a financial one. It's more sort of a presentation tool.
And what is the relationship with the main Basel Art Fair?
I would think the relationship is on, the main difference is purely a financial question. This is a much cheaper place, a much more flexible place, which is more appropriate for younger artists and younger galleries, and the other one is more appropriate for more established work, more established gallery, a different public. Though there is enough exchange between the two that it's actually okay, they're quite close, you can walk easily between one and the other, which is actually one good quality of this setup.
Have you identified any general concerns that come through what's being presented here?
In a very complex way, I would say yes, in the sense of going away from any established track and going away from any very recognizable trend. It's not true that there is this return to painting, for example. There is some people painting, but also a lot of it not. It seems that it's really the most diverse period I've seen since I'm involved with art. It's really the most flexible period when everybody's vaguely unsatisfied with the way things are, but nobody has a formula, which makes it quite exciting, actually.
Well, now I'm on the stand of Gallery Paul Andressi from Amsterdam. How are you finding this List 96?
Right, well, we are quite enthusiastic because there are good galleries and there's some good work to be seen. And especially the atmosphere is completely different. It's pretty informal.
As we can hear, there's a lot of activity and so on. I mean, it's got the feeling of a fair in the process of construction. It's not as formal, perhaps, as the other Basel Art Fair. What is the link between the two?
Well, the organizers, they took the initiative for this fair because for younger galleries, it's hard to participate on the official fair. I mean, this is not far as expensive, so people can take far more risk and they bring much more adventurous work, I think. So here you find you have a good chance finding artists you might not know that well or even never heard of.
Now on the stand of Galleria Paolo Vittolo from Milano, what is your reaction to being in this fair from Milan?
For me, it's anyway a difficult fair because my gallery is only a gallery of proposals of young artists.
So now I'm on the stand of a gallery from Paris called Air de Paris. To begin with, tell me what you think is important about this young art fair in Basel.
It offers, in a period where there are many financial problems, it offers a possibility to be there at the same time than the main fair and for less money. Obviously not a fair which would be defined mainly by a choice of artists, but more by a financial situation.
Well, now I'm on the stand of Galleria Neue from Berlin, and I'm interested to know, first of all, what is your impression of List 96, the young art fair here in Basel?
Yeah, it's a really good organized art fair, and we like the atmosphere very much. It's good, yeah?
What are the primary differences between the main art fair in Basel and this one?
Like here is more like the young contemporary art scene, like some established galleries also mixed with young and new galleries. So I find that more interest than like these statement things in at the big fair. So
second reason, it's not so huge that you can, there are only 30 galleries and some spaces, and you can see all in 2 hours or 3 hours.
Well, now I'm talking to Selina Andren from Sweden. What is the name of your gallery?
Andren Shipchenko, and I run it together with a partner, Marina Shipchenko. That's the name.
Do you think there are any specific trends or characteristics that you would use to describe the work here?
One trend with a lot of contemporary artists today is that they work in several different media. You do not longer have painter, sculptors, but a lot of the artists here, they work in very different media, expressing a specific idea or a specific set of concepts, but using different kinds of media. And I also think a lot of the artists today tend to work around everyday, quite trivial issues in many ways, but they work in sort of a small scale, quite intimate work. It revolves around intimate concepts.
Well, now I'm on the stand of another gallery from Berlin. The gallery is called Aunt and Partner, and perhaps you could start by telling us who you are.
Yes, hello. So I'm working with Aunt and Partners since January, but the gallery was opened in October 1994 in Berlin Mitte.
So what do you think of it? I mean, has it been successful for you?
Yes, so far it was successful. We're happy that the organization is well done, that a lot of people going to the art are also going to the young art fair. The space concept is much different from a usual art fair, where you walk from one booth to the other, from one line in the next one, and where you get very quickly kind of a, you know, you're just, it's too much. And so here you have the chance to go out, have a coffee, come in, go to the next floor.
So, Judy Lipka, from Eigen and Art.
From Eigen and Art.
Berlin and Leipzig.
Yes, true.
What is your view of Lister 96?
Beautiful, interesting people, a lot of collectors. It was 4 years I was every year in Basel on the bigger main fair. Now I have paid every year 35,000 marks, so around four. Now I pay here 3,500 for all, and that's make me more free. I think it's much better, and a lot of these collectors, she doesn't see me in Basel real, but it's 280 galleries and more, and she must go running around now and see all these friends and never come in my booth or quick look. And now here in this fair, all these collectors, all the museums guys looking for the 35 galleries, but only 35 galleries in this house, and see what's going on. And I think that's really important.
So you are from Belgium. Can you tell me the name of the gallery?
Yeah, it's Zeno X from Belgium, from city of Antwerpen.
And how do you think the fair has gone for you?
It's a very good fair in the meaning of interest. People who come here are not really buyers or collectors. They come also, but not in such a big amount like at the other fair. Here it's mostly young people. We are very interested in young art, and they come here and they really look to the artwork, and they're standing for a long time in the booth and they ask good questions, and it's a good atmosphere. It's more like loose, and it's more hanging between the booths and talking, and between the gallery keepers and assistants. It's all more, not so like competitive, it's more like give an international platform for artists. We didn't make it already.
Well, I'm now on the stand of a gallery from Spain called Espacio Mínimo Are you the only gallery from Spain here at List 96?
Yes, we are the only gallery from Spain, and we are very happy to take part in this event, because, for example, the principal reason is the program of the galleries who take part in this fair has a common spirit.
My name is Anne de Villepoix, and my gallery is Galerie Anne de Villepoix in Paris.
So what's your experience then of this art fair in Basel, this List 96?
First, it's my first art fair in Basel, but I think it's a great experience because we really enjoy to be there. We can meet a lot of people. I think most of the collectors and the curator and journalists and critics are coming and see us. We don't have the normal public, but only people who are really interested in contemporary art. So, I mean, I think people pay a lot of attention about what we show and what we are doing. And I think it was just a fantastic experience.
Will you come back?
Yes, of course. Oh, I would love to come back.
Well, now downstairs at Lister 96, the Jack Handley Gallery from San Francisco. It's a long way to come to Basel, so you must have a very good reason.
Well, it seemed like most of the collectors, a lot of American collectors I knew come to Basel, and I had come to Basel every year anyway just to see the fair, the big fair. And so when there was the possibility of doing this small one that seemed inexpensive and you could bring younger artists' work, it seemed like a worthwhile gamble.
Can you stand back sufficiently from the fair and the work by younger artists here to get any kind of overview about any dominant or predominant trend or agenda?
Well, there seems to be still some interest in politically motivated work, maybe not overtly political, but like Karsten Holler is in a number of booths, and I'm a big fan of his work. And in his work, I mean, deals with like science kind of gone awry, so it's sort of political in terms of what happens. And then I think that there's a lot of installation. It's a lot less of a tendency maybe for painting at the moment still. And there's a lot of video. I'm surrounded on two sides with videos here and audio.
So now I'm talking to Dan Bernier from Los Angeles. So tell me how things have gone so far. Are you pleased?
I'm very pleased so far. The fair is just about over now. There's one day left, and there's been, I think, really strong response to the artists that I work with.
Can we finally talk about some of the pieces you've got here, and the piece we're sitting next to, which is producing the crackling sound that we can hear in the background?
It's called Circle Amplification, and it's by a Los Angeles artist named Martin Kersells. It's actually a magnet that's behind a piece of paper, and it's dragging iron filings around the paper, making this endless, kind of continuous drawing. And the microphone is picking up the scraping of the iron filings on the paper.
Okay, well, perhaps we could just hear it a bit more now. So if I move to a position where I can record the sound. So now I'm talking to Fenia Brester from Düsseldorf. You're an artist and you've come to see List 96 here in Basel. What is your impression of this fair?
Nice, very well organized, good atmosphere.
Can you see any general characteristic in the artists' works here?
I don't think so, because we had already at Cologne at the fair, the unfair, and it's nearly similar what happened there and what is happening now here. It's only more quiet, more professional organized here. It's really a kind of parallel way to the general art fair we have here in Basel. It has not so much the anti-touch.
And now I'm talking to Peter Bloyer, who is the organizer of List 96. Peter, can we start by you giving me some background to how this fair came about here in Basel?
Yes, I mean, since year it was always a problem for young galleries to participate on the big fair, the art, a very important art fair for sure. And so young galleries from two young galleries from Zurich. They had the idea we have to do something for the, about the time is very difficult for art dealers, and so they asked me if I'm interested to organize an art fair for young galleries and especially for who shows art from the 90s. We started actually with an international committee. That's Maureen Paley from Interim Art London. It's Anne de Villepra from Paris. It's Amy Fontana from Milano. It's Neuger Riemschneider from Berlin and the two galleries from Zurich, Peter Kilchmann and Eva Presenhuber from Galerie Walchenturm. So this committee did a list. Who would they like on our art fair? Which galleries? So there was about a list of 45 international galleries. And we invited them to participate in our art fair. And I would say 35 of these 45 decided to be on our art fair. So the list was already full, the list 96. And of course, after that, we had, of course, a lot of phone calls. Everybody wanted to participate. So also we have now a long waiting list. I would say 90% of what we can see is really art of the 90s. Of course, there are young artists, so it's, some of them don't have the level of an artist who work already 30 years or so. But I think we have an impression of what happens today in the 90s about art.
Stuart Brisley, we're here in the South London Art Gallery in your exhibition, which I believe is titled Black. What is notable about these new works in black is their, and I quote, humble scale. And I must say, when I came into the gallery the other evening to see the exhibition for the first time, this did surprise me to some extent because of one's expectations associated with the earlier works I've seen, which often incorporated even the performance works, elaborate and sometimes dramatic interventions. So this exhibition is relatively quiet. It's almost museum-like. I was wondering whether there's some sort of strategic intention in making an exhibition of this sort.
The reason that the work has actually changed in scale is not dependent on the idea of having an exhibition and having a strategy. What I felt around probably around about the late 80s into the beginning of the 90s was very much connected to something called the Cenotaph Project, which was a very public project. Arising from that project, I felt that I wanted to deal with things on an entirely different scale, in a sense to work as a, perhaps more traditionally as an artist might have done. And so I, in a way, withdrew to studio and began to work on objects at that time that I felt had a place relative to earlier work that I had done, but the means by which I arrived at those these objects was rather different. So there are numbers of reasons as to, I think, why the work actually reduced itself in scale. There's another major reason, and that is that I become completely disaffected with the notion of spectacle. Yeah, not that I mean, I've never really kind of thought that I was particularly engaged in spectacle, although some of the work that I'd done had its drama. I certainly would admit that. I wanted to, in a way, make things at a much more human scale, not just to say human scale, but of a particular human scale, because I think the earlier ones were also of a human scale, to make things that were of a particular human scale, so that one was in a sense forced to go up to it, to almost be part of it, to have a more intimate relationship with it. Those are some of the ideas, I think, that I've been concerned with.
Shall we move now to the left? Now we have a piece called Chair, which is attached to the... Well, it is originally a chair attached to the wall. covered with encrustation, and beneath it on the floor, again, there's the discarded materials of either cleaning or wiping or getting rid of evidence or trying to get rid of a mess.
I initially thought of this as sort of like the chair of the board, or the, you know, the chair, the chair, not just as a physical object, but also its symbol, what it symbolizes in relation to institutions. So you have the chair of the board, the chair of fine art, you know, like there's numbers of ways that one could interpret it, and the chair is actually full of shit, really, so that it is both difficult to accept and also is actually inherently defiled or over history or whatever period of time is also compromised. Is very difficult to accept, because to accept it is actually to be covered in it. To experience it is actually also to distribute it. And so that the what falls from the chair are, you know, various kinds of edicts or judgments, directives which fall, and you know they very quickly become mute residues. So and also the chair is often the subject of much abuse for various reasons, and hence the wall is also marked, as it were, around the chair. So this is how I was thinking of it, you know. I mean, whether the real meaning resides there, I'm not sure, but that was the way I thought of it.
There is a critique and anger within that proposition that you've just elucidated, to do with authority and to do with hierarchy, and a challenge to, yes, both those things.
Yes, I think, because one often gets the sense that these structures, which are set up for a sort of fluent interchange and expression of, you know, of institutions within society, actually become antipathetic to that and become blocks. In a way, it is quite a protesting work, and it's about the way in which human beings are in a way reduced to conditions which are express less than their potential. You know, where people are actually are reduced, become one-dimensional.
Should we go around the screen, Stuart, where you've got a number of images now of the royal family, and again, there was something in your catalogue which was to do with a critique of the way in which the monarchy has started to implode on itself in the late 20th century. Of course, so many institutions now are being challenged, and the monarchy being one of them. And here we have an image of Lady Diana, splattered with white within a dark rectangle, then on a larger white screen with bits of tissue, I think, stuck to the screen.
This is an image that comes from, I think it was the 17th of October 1994, on the headline, of the front page rather, of the Daily Mirror. And I forget exactly what little crisis this represents. And the photograph was of Princess Diana Carr, and it was raining, and so you had lots of drips on the window. And that gave me the idea of the related to the way in which the press seemed to exploit the very real difficulties of the monarchy. On the one hand, euphorically and in a sycophantic fashion supporting monarchy without any question, and on the other hand undermining it through exposing the vicissitudes of individuals who within the monarchy. So there's a kind of schizophrenia involved in the way that the press seem to operate. Also, there's a complicity that monarchy has with it at the same time. So there's a strange kind of triumvate, convenient interactions that take place for different motivations. So this represents, in a sense, that complexity. So Dai is being photographed. She's complicitly allowing herself to be photographed, possibly. And yet that in that act and in those acts which take place quite regularly, there is a kind of there's a kind of diminution of value. There's a kind of exploitation. So I've used that sense of exploitation by suggesting that this is a pornographic condition. And pornographic images are often used for masturbation. Hence, I've painted this as a seminal S-E-M-E-N-A-L, semen al portrait. So this is as though the press were acting as the pimps for, you know, people to masturbate. And I think there is an aspect of that in the way the press actually operates, which is my interpretation, or it's an individual interpretation, if you like, of this curious interaction between press and monarchy at the present time.
And presumably because of the way in which what could be regarded as the sort of superficial dimensions of monarchy, that is the glamour and the privilege and the sparkle and the spectacle, yeah, whilst that's being appropriated and celebrated for consumption in the national press internationally, the actual reality of an institution sort of falling to pieces and crumbling is not addressed.
No, it's not. And of course, if we say that the monarchy is actually the epitome of the in a sense the class system in Britain, one can and what you just and think of it in the terms of what you just said, you have a society at in a state of dissolution, or in a state of decay. And you have really a kind of media representation which gives no indication in any conscious way that this is taking place, but expresses it through its own unconscious involvement.
Looping the central containers of information, controlled culture, civic control. Cracking this heart open, open like an egg, open like a head, out oozes dross and speckled stardust. Crushed human nature lies in bleeding fragments all over the face of society, all over the pavements, blast in the full light of our immaculate candelabras, chandeliers. A magnificence built on the blood of slavery, red raw cotton, strange hanging fruit. So onwards to Ancoats, where even in the sickly dark, flying birds are mouths, flying birds. This place of critical hurt and psycho-catastrophe, where atmospheric children roamed half giddy with noise and endless motion, sweeping between machines of the most beautiful contrivance, spreading soft, dirty yarns through white milk teeth, kissing the shuttle half giddy, we squeeze between machines and secrete our own psycho smears along this great grieving artery. Grieving, 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 grieving. Grieving into strange ways, walls, deliciously curved. Even so, a masculine building, a men-only building. Note the watchtower. Note inside, turgid with pain stuff. All raspings, prickles, tiny broken-up bits of crunch stuff. No, guttle, engorge. Under their beds, gritty bits of dead skin quiver. Vitreous laments. Elegant deformations of glass. Passing the septum, the no-go territorial stamp, stamp, unguessed land of twitching lace. Nervous curtains chop off your gaze. Mop it up, mop it up. And some sort of door here and there opens, unopens, inch opens. Slit face half unlit in the blood-breeding shadows. Brood-bleeding shadows. And the floatwalkers dream on by, daubed and blighted with nibbled teas of neon. There ain't no government like no government. Us loonies, you scumbags. And the morning after the night before the pavement, after the happy hour night before the day even started, it turned sour. And a fist kiss curled into fright, and like magic knuckles everywhere whiten up, and the wide boys leg it like fucking pelicans. Cities conspire to wreck the heart. And spaces open and shut. Eat, breathe, beat, swallow. The ever-beating peristalsis, eating, but eating, but eating, but eating, but eating, but eating.
This is where the journey begins. In another city, late at night, in my little boy's bedroom. On the table is a map. It has no street names, no buildings, no clues at all. Between my thumb and forefinger is a thread of cotton, and from the thread hangs a piece of crystal an inch above the map. I hold still, hanging over a point on the paper. I hold still, and the streets begin to blur.
And the crystal,
and the crystal
starts to swing.
Starts to swing. And I follow its direction down the road. Uh-oh. We're off. I follow the pendulum over the map with a pencil, leaving an orange line that wanders through the city. Just here, as we turn the corner, two straight roads split at a fork. A short cross street connects them as they spread apart. And on the map, it looks like a letter A. From there, the orange line hooks a left into a nuggety cluster of cubes. A figure eight. A letter B. From the apex of the A to the bottom of the B. An alphabet. An A to Z. A is for amnesia, B is for blur. Alphabets become describing everything forgotten. A gathering hidden impressions. Make A new B orders. A putting quotation marks. B line. Round solid thought. B C underlying value. C words. B C Z C D Yacht. C D Zebra D pad.
Passage CD part of town. Around Birmingham CD cars drive endlessly CD forwards going home in journal blur knotted lanes motor noise oil puddles queues restless stationary traffic FG untold vehicles wait. Hours later, the pendulum has swung its way around the entire map and finished where it started. My eyes can no longer focus on the orange line. Jake, what is it? What's it all about? My dear. Well, the line is in the inside cover of a children's book, an adventure book, and it shows the map of their adventures in which they... Save the world. No P. There's no P. It's gone. No P. No P. It's the trace of thought. There's no P. Q. Q. R. War. War. It's the trace of a thought as it passes through brain tissue. Arrest. 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 You. And what's the thought? Under. Arrest. You. V. UV light. UV dark. UV getting darker. VW garage. Street. VW. X. Y. What is it? YZ. What's it all about? Ah. Birmingham City. Delirious entity. Far green hills. Industrial junkyard. Keep life moving, new open places, quirky receptacle, singing town, urban vendors world. Ah, Birmingham City does exist for Ghanaian, Hindi, Islamic Jews, kaleidoscopic languages, markets, noisy old price busters, quilted rumples, swinging there under various windows. Alpha Beta City defines everything. Fat guys hang out in jeweled knickers, loud mouthed newlyweds, old people, quick runners, silent thinkers, unsung victors with xylophones, yodel, zigzag anthems. Birmingham can't die, even forsaken girls, homeless individuals jostle curbside life, making noise overwhelming people's quarter, reverberate sound through untold valleys of windows, xylophones, yachts, zebras, ant bites, chocolate drops, elephant butts, greasy hobnobs, indigo jelly knobs. Life. Meaning. Nothing.
Oh,